The prisons in the United States had long been an extreme reflection of the American system itself. The stark life differences between rich and poor, the racism, the use of victims against one another, the lack of resources of the underclass to speak out, the endless reforms that changed little. Dostoevsky once said, "The degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons." It had long been true, and prisoners knew this better than anyone, that the poorer you were, the more likely you were to end up in jail. This was not just because the poor committed more crimes. In fact, they did. The rich did not have to commit crimes to get what they wanted. The laws were on their side. But when the rich did commit crimes, they often were not prosecuted, and if they were, they could get out on bail, hire clever lawyers, get better treatment from judges. Somehow the jails ended up full of poor black people. In 1969, there were 502 convictions for tax fraud. Such cases, called white-collar crimes, usually involve people with a good deal of money. Of those convicted, 20% ended up in jail. The fraud averaged $190,000 per case. Their sentences averaged 7 months. That same year, for burglary and auto theft, crimes of the poor, 60% ended up in prison. The auto thefts averaged $992. The sentences averaged 18 months. The burglaries averaged $321. The sentences averaged 33 months. Willard Galen, a psychiatrist, relates, partial justice, a case which, with changes in details, could be multiplied thousands of times. He had just interviewed 17 Jehovah's Witnesses who refused to register for the draft during the Vietnam War, and all had received 2-year sentences. He came to a young black man who had notified his draft board he could not in conscience cooperate with the draft because he was repelled by the violence of the Vietnam War. He received a 5-year sentence. Galen writes, "Hanks was the first 5-year sentence I had encountered. He was also the first black man." There were additional factors. "How was your hair then?" I asked. "Afro." "And what were you wearing?" "A dashiki." "Don't you think that might have affected your sentence?" "Of course." "Was it worth a year or two of your life?" I asked. "That's all of my life," he said, looking at me with a combination of dismay and confusion. "Man, don't you know that's what it's all about? Am I free to have my style? Am I free to have my hair? Am I free to have my skin?" "Of course," I said. "You're right." Galen found enormous discretion given to judges in the handing out of sentences. In Oregon, of 33 men convicted of violating the draft law, 18 were put on probation. In southern Texas, of 16 men violating the same law, none was put on probation. And in southern Mississippi, every defendant was convicted and given the maximum of 5 years. In one part of the country, New England, the average sentence for all crimes was 11 months. In another part, the South, it was 78 months. But it wasn't simply a matter of North and South. In New York City, one judge handling 673 persons brought before him for public drunkenness, all poor, the rich get drunk behind closed doors, discharged 531 of them. Another judge, handling 566 persons on the same charge, discharged one person. With such power in the hands of the courts, the poor, the black, the odd, the homosexual, the hippie, the radical, are not likely to get equal treatment before judges who are almost uniformly white, upper-middle-class, orthodox. While in any one year, 1972, for instance, perhaps 375,000 people will be in jail, county or city, or in prison, state or federal, and 54,000 in juvenile detention, there will also be 900,000 under probation and 300,000 on parole, a total of 1,600,000 people affected by the criminal justice system. Considering turnover in any one year, several million people will come in and go out of this system. It is a population largely invisible to middle-class America. But if 20 million blacks could be invisible for so long, why not 4 or 5 million criminals? A study by the Children's Defense Fund, Thomas Cottle, Children in Jail, in the mid-70s, revealed that more than 900,000 young people under 18 are jailed in the course of a year. Anyone trying to describe the reality of prison falters. A man in Walpole Prison in Massachusetts wrote, "Every program that we get is used as a weapon against us. The right to go to school, to go to church, to have visitors, to write, to go to the movies. They all end up being weapons of punishment. None of the programs are ours. Everything is treated as a privilege that can be taken away from us. The result is insecurity, a frustration that keeps eating away at you." Another Walpole prisoner. "I haven't eaten in the mess hall for 4 years. I just couldn't take it anymore. You'd go into the serving line in the morning and 100 or 200 cockroaches would go running away from the trays. The trays were grimy and the food was raw or had dirt or maggots in it. Many a night I'd go hungry, living on peanut butter and sandwiches, getting a loaf of bread here or a hunk of bologna there. Other guys couldn't do that because they didn't have my connections or they didn't have money for the canteen." Communication with the outside world was difficult. Guards would tear up letters. Others would be intercepted and read. Jerry Souza, a prisoner at Walpole in 1970, sent 2 letters, one to a judge, the other to the parole board, to tell about a beating by guards. They went unanswered. 8 years later, at a court hearing, he discovered the prison authorities had intercepted them, never sent them out. The families suffered with the prisoner. "During the last lockup, my 4-year-old son sneaked off into the yard and picked me a flower." A guard in the tower called the warden's office and a deputy came in with the state police at his side. He announced that if any child went into the yard and picked another flower, all visits would be terminated. The prison rebellions of the late 60s and early 70s had a distinctly different character than the earlier ones. The prisoners in the Queen's House of Detention referred to themselves as revolutionaries. All over the country, prisoners were obviously affected by the turmoil in the country, the Black Revolt, the youth upsurge, the anti-war movement. The events of those years underlined what prisoners already sensed, that whatever crimes they had committed, the greatest crimes were being committed by the authorities who maintained the prisons, by the government of the United States. The law was being broken daily by the president, sending bombers to kill, sending men to be killed, outside the Constitution, outside the highest law of the land. State and local officials were violating the civil rights of Black people, which was against the law, and were not being prosecuted for it. Literature about the Black movement, books on the war, began to seep into the prisons. The example set in the streets by Blacks, by anti-war demonstrators, was exhilarating. Against a lawless system, defiance was the only answer. It was a system which sentenced Martin Sostra, a 52-year-old Black man running an Afro-Asian bookstore in Buffalo, New York, to 25 to 30 years in prison for allegedly selling $15 worth of heroin to an informer who later recanted his testimony. The recantation did not free Sostra. He could find no court, including the Supreme Court of the United States, to revoke the judgment. He spent 8 years in prison, was beaten 10 times by guards, spent 3 years in solitary confinement, battling and defying the authorities all the way until his release. Such injustice deserved only rebellion. There had always been political prisoners, people sent to jail for belonging to radical movements, for opposing war. But now a new kind of political prisoner appeared, the man or woman convicted of an ordinary crime, who in prison became awakened politically. Some prisoners began making connections between their personal ordeal and the social system. They then turned not to individual rebellion, but to collective action. They became concerned, amid an environment whose brutality demanded concentration on one's own safety, an atmosphere of cruel rivalry, for the rights, the safety of others. George Jackson was one of these new political prisoners. In Soledad Prison, California, on an indeterminate sentence for a $70 robbery, having already served 10 years of it, Jackson became a revolutionary. He spoke with a fury that matched his condition. "This monster, the monster they've engendered in me, will return to torment its maker, from the grave, the pit, the profoundest pit. Hurl me into the next existence. The descent into hell won't turn me. I'm going to charge them reparations in blood. I'm going to charge them like a maddened, wounded, rogue male elephant, ears flared, trunk raised, trumpet blaring. War without terms. A prisoner like this would not last, and when his book Soledad Brother became one of the most widely read books of black militancy in the United States, by prisoners, by black people, by white people, perhaps this ensured he would not last. He further wrote, "All my life I've done exactly what I wanted to do just when I wanted, no more, perhaps less sometimes, but never any more, which explains why I had to be jailed. I never adjusted. I haven't adjusted even yet, with half of my life already in prison." He knew what might happen. Born to a premature death, a menial subsistence wage worker, odd job man, the cleaner, the caught, the man under hatches, without bail. That's me, the colonial victim. Anyone who can pass the civil service examination today can kill me tomorrow, with complete immunity. In August 1971, he was shot in the back by guards at San Quentin Prison while he was allegedly trying to escape. The state's story, analyzed by Eric Mann and Comrade George, was full of holes. Prisoners in jails and state prisons all over the country knew even before the final autopsy was in, even before later disclosures suggested a government plot to kill Jackson, that he had been murdered for daring to be a revolutionary in prison. Shortly after Jackson's death, there was a chain of rebellions around the country, in San Jose Civic Center Jail, in Dallas County Jail, in Suffolk County Jail in Boston, in Cumberland County Jail in Bridgeton, New Jersey, in Bexar County Jail in San Antonio, Texas. The most direct effect of the George Jackson murder was the rebellion at Attica Prison in September 1971, a rebellion that came from long, deep grievances, but that was raised to boiling point by the news about George Jackson. Attica was surrounded by a 30-foot wall, 2 feet thick, with 14 gun towers. 54% of the inmates were black. 100% of the guards were white. Prisoners spent 14 to 16 hours a day in their cells. Their mail was read, their reading material restricted, their visits from families conducted through a mesh screen, their medical care disgraceful, their parole system inequitable, racism everywhere. How perceptive the prison administration was about these conditions can be measured by the comment of the superintendent of Attica, Vincent Mancusi, when the uprising began. Why are they destroying their home? Most of the Attica prisoners were there as a result of plea bargaining. Of 32,000 felony indictments a year in New York State, 4,000 to 5,000 were tried. The rest, about 75%, were disposed of by deals made under duress, called plea bargaining, described as follows in the report of the Joint Legislative Committee on Crime in New York. The final climactic act in the plea bargaining procedure is a charade which in itself has aspects of dishonesty which rival the original crime in many instances. The accused is made to assert publicly his guilt on a specific crime, which in many cases he has not committed. In some cases, he pleads guilty to a non-existing crime. He must further indicate that he is entering his plea freely and that he is not doing so because of any promise made to him. In plea bargaining, the accused pleads guilty, whether he is or not, and saves the state the trouble of a trial in return for the promise of a less severe punishment. When Attica prisoners were up for parole, the average time of their hearing, including the reading of the file and deliberation among the three members, was 5.9 minutes. Then the decision was handed out, with no explanation.